Good afternoon from the University of Southern California, and welcome to From Where We Are from Annenberg Radio News. For December 3rd, 2015, I'm Carla Javier. First, a news update with Sebastian Vega.
President Obama said this morning that the FBI is still looking for a motive in the San Bernardino shooting that killed 14 and injured 21 people.
It is possible that this was terrorist related, but we don't know. It's also possible that this was workplace related.
The suspects are identified as Saeed Farouk and his wife Tashfeen Malik. At a news conference this morning, police said that the suspects fired 65 to 75 rifle rounds during a Christmas party at the Inland Regional Center where Farouk worked. A homemade bomb was also found, but it never went off. Police say they're confident that Farouk and Malik are the only suspects in the shooting. They were both killed in a shootout with police yesterday. The FBI is still investigating a motive, but there are reports that Farouk had been in contact with people under investigation by the FBI for international terrorism. We'll have more on the San Bernardino shootings later in our program. The Senate voted against expanding background checks on gun buyers today. The news comes after questions remain about how suspects in yesterday's San Bernardino shooting came to possess a pair of military-style rifles. In California, it is legal for guns to swap hands through private deals between owners. Kevin Walker has more.
The California Department of Justice says almost 1 million guns were sold or transferred this year. Many of those transactions were private deals made between individual gun owners.
It's called a private party transfer.
That's Sam Paredes. He's executive director of Gun Owners of California, a pro-gun lobbying group. He says California's gun transfer laws are among the strongest in the country.
If you want to sell a gun to a friend, both of you have to go to a dealer. The dealer takes it into their inventory.
At which point, the gun buyer will have to wait 10 days for a background check.
And after 10 days, they can come if they have been cleared by the government as a legal to purchase the firearm, then they can pick it up.
California gun laws may be tough, but there are concerns about other states with more relaxed regulations. Ari Freelich, an attorney with the Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence, is especially worried about sales online.
If I'm a private party, if I'm an online retailer, I'm not asked to conduct any kind of background check or figure out whether you're a prohibited dangerous individual.
The ATF says the military-style rifles used in the attack were not purchased by the suspects. The guns themselves were legal under California law, but officials have not commented on how they came into Saeed Farouk and Tashfeen Malik's possession before yesterday's shooting. Kevin Walker, Annenberg Radio News.
A former California Highway Patrol officer who was caught on camera beating a woman walking alongside the Santa Monica Freeway will not face charges. Caitlin Plummer has more.
A former California Highway Patrol officer who was caught on camera beating a woman walking alongside the Santa Monica Freeway will not face charges. Prosecutors ruled there was insufficient evidence to prove Officer Daniel Andrew used unreasonable force against Marlene Pinnock last year. Cell phone video shows Andrew sitting on top of Pinnock and repeatedly punching her in the head. Prosecutors say the cell phone only captured 42 seconds of an encounter that lasted 9 minutes. District Attorney Jack Lacey said the evidence shows Andrew acted legally to protect his life as well as Pinnock's and drivers on the freeway. Civil rights activist Najee Ali today criticized the release of the decision 1 day after the San Bernardino shooting, and he called for Lacey's resignation. Caitlin Plummer, Annenberg Radio News.
Governor Jerry Brown and Mayor Eric Garcetti are both in Paris today attending the UN Climate Summit. And here in LA, hundreds of nurses, and environmental activists rallied downtown to call attention to the local impact of global warming. Tashina Fleming reports.
My community needs a climate change now.
Nurses, activists, scientists, and doctors demonstrated at Pershing Square to push for a switch from fossil fuels to sustainable energy. Dr. Paul Song, a radiologist, sees the health repercussions in his own waiting room.
These warmer temperatures have allowed insects previously stopped by cold weather to flourish and spread more diseases.
Rising temperatures are increasing infectious diseases like malaria, dengue fever, cholera, and Lyme disease. It also affects air quality. According to the World Health Organization, more than 8 million deaths worldwide are directly attributable to air pollution. Bakersfield has the second worst air quality in the nation, due largely to big agriculture, fracking, and traffic. Rachel Hernandez has been a nurse at Bakersfield Memorial Hospital in the pediatric department for 5 years.
We have a lot of kids who just, they can't go outside and play. Our air quality is terrible.
An agreement is expected to be reached to reduce greenhouse emissions globally on December 11th at the UN Climate Conference. Tashina Fleming, Annenberg Radio News.
I'm Sebastian Vega, and it's 5 minutes after the hour. Thanks for listening to our news updates this semester. From Where We Are is up next.
The nation's attention is still riveted on the mass shooting in San Bernardino. Officials now say that in addition to 14 people killed, 21 were wounded. This makes it the worst mass shooting since Sandy Hook in 2012, when 26 people died. Aziza Kasumov reports on the latest news in yesterday's shooting.
We learned today that the weapon arsenal gathered by the suspects was extensive. At a news conference this morning, San Bernardino Police Chief Jared Bergen described the weapons found at the couple's house in Redlands, a city close to San Bernardino.
There were 12 pipe bomb type devices found in that house or in the garage to that house. There were also hundreds of tools, many of which could be used to construct IEDs or pipe bombs.
Police say the huge arsenal suggests the couple could have been planning an even more deadly attack than the one yesterday. They used two assault rifles and two semi-automatic handguns in the attacks. Authorities say they were all legally purchased and registered, though it is still unclear who originally bought the guns. The attack happened at a holiday party at the Inland Regional Center, where one of the suspects, Saeed Farouk, worked. Farouk reportedly left the party angry, but officials don't think this was only a spontaneous response to a work dispute.
There appears to be a degree of planning that went into this. Nobody just gets upset at a party, goes home, and puts together that kind of an elaborate scheme or plan to come back and do that. So there was some planning that went into this.
Police believe the only attackers were 20-year-old Farouk, an American citizen, and his 27-year-old wife, Tashfeen Malik, who is a Pakistani citizen but held a legal visa for the U.S. The couple married 2 years ago and had a 6-month-old daughter who they left with Farouk's mother the morning of the attack. The suspects died in a shootout with the police shortly after the attack. Farouk's brother-in-law spoke at a news conference last night, saying he didn't know why Farouk would have done this. As of now, FBI investigations on the couple's motivations are still ongoing.
This is not your average investigation. We have multiple scenes, we have many victims, and it will take time. There are a tremendous number of assets and resources being applied to this investigation.
Media reports say the FBI is treating the attack as a possible terrorism act. Two FBI officers told the New York Times that Farouk had connections to radical Islamists in the U.S. and abroad. He also traveled to Saudi Arabia several times over the last few years. Aziza Kazumov, Annenberg Radio News.
The names of the victims in the San Bernardino attack are starting to be released to the public. Here are a few of the victims we know about. One victim was Daniel Kaufman, who ran the coffee shop at the Inland Regional Center. His boyfriend waited for 22 hours to hear his fate. Damian Mines worked for Riverside County for 28 years. He'd recently returned to the Environmental Health Agency after retiring in 2010. Nicholas Thalassinos was an environmental health inspector who worked closely with the suspected shooter. He leaves behind a wife and two adult sons. Also lost yesterday was Mike Wetzel, a father of 6 children who ranged in age from infant to mid-teens. He is described as a devoted family man. Women make up only 20% of the United States Congress, yet women are more than 50% of the U.S. population. The United States is ranked 72nd in the world for gender equality in government. The organization Elect Her is trying to change those numbers. The group came to USC recently to meet with students from the Undergraduate Student Government, Women's Student Assembly, and the Pan-Hellenic Council. Brianna Feldot reports.
Elect Her is a program that trains and encourages women to enter politics and represent their gender in an often unbalanced world. They say gender biases can discourage girls and women from running for office. Monica Garcia, a councilwoman from the city of Baldwin Park, explained how self-confidence plays into leadership roles.
I think too often we doubt, you know, what we actually bring to the table. We limit ourselves.
Without many female role models in office, it can be daunting for women to run. One elector representative explained that without mentors in office or political positions, women are discouraged and come to doubt their eligibility. With undergraduate student government elections quickly approaching, USC student body president Rini Sampath said gender double standards often prevent women and girls from running for office.
Because sometimes when women are assertive, they're perceived as a bitch, but when a man does it, it's kind of different.
But Sampath also shared that she was encouraged to run so that she could make a difference.
I really wanted to make an impact on our campus through student government and advocate for the needs of all students, despite who they are or where they come from.
Sampath is the first woman president at USC in 10 years, a step perhaps in the right direction. So as elections approach, don't be discouraged, but find comfort in the fact that it looks like times are changing. Brianna Feldot, Annenberg Radio News.
A new law goes into effect in January that recognizes modern families in California. Stephanie Haney tells us more.
LA County Public Health Registrar's Ayla Molina says that up until the end of this year, California's law on birth certificates puts same-sex male couples in an awkward position.
We can't leave the mom box incomplete. It has to be a name in there.
This means that same-sex male couples who use surrogates to have babies have been forced to list at least one parent's name under the mother field. Starting in January, the California birth certificate fields relating to parents will be completely gender neutral. There will be optional checkboxes for each parent to identify their relationship to the child as mother, father, or parent. But for couples using surrogates, there is still an extra step.
They need to have the court order before the hospital birth clerk to complete the certificate.
Parents adopting children also need a court order to get their names on the birth certificate, but those requests are sent straight to the state. Proponents of traditional marriage say that birth certificates should only include biological parent information as anthropological records. But the state says the official purpose of issuing a birth certificate is to provide a vital record that documents the birth of a child in California and establishes proof of an individual's identity. The new law takes effect January 1st. Stephanie Haney, Annenberg Radio News.
An increasing number of tenants in Los Angeles are being evicted from rent-controlled apartments using a law known as the Ellis Act. I talked to one 71-year-old tenant about how he's fighting his eviction. His name is Walt Centerfit, and he loves his one-bedroom apartment, but now he's looking for a new home, and he has to find it soon.
Clock ticking. It's a little over 2 months, 60 days.
He's lived at Rodney Drive in Los Feliz for 8 years. 4 years ago, the nice family that used to own his building sold it. The new landlord came in wanting to charge higher rent. But the landlord couldn't just raise the rents because they're stabilized. They can only go up by about 3% each year. The only way to get around the ordinance is if the current tenants left.
So at first he came around and tried to bribe us to leave, but he offered very low ball amounts.
And when that didn't work, he started what Centerfit calls petty harassment.
Oh, you have flowers on the balcony. That's not allowed. You have a satellite dish, even though it was done with permission. That's not allowed. Oh, there's an oil spot under your car in the garage. That's not allowed.
It was annoying, but the tenants dealt with it. Then in January, the new landlord officially gave Centerfit, his husband, and the tenants in the other apartments their 180-day notice. He was evicting them.
And it's like the rug's being pulled out from under your life, and you go wobbling or falling down and go through all of the kinds of reactions of shock. This can't be happening. Oh, this is happening. What am I going to do?
Landlords can't just evict people whenever they like. It's bad business, and in a lot of cases, it's illegal. But the landlord at Rodney Drive can evict tenants under a very specific state law, the Ellis Act. And he's not the only landlord doing it. Data from the Los Angeles Housing and Community Investment Department shows Los Angeles landlords evicted tenants from 725 units last year. That's more than double the Ellis Act evictions from 2013. But to evict tenants legally, landlords have to follow pretty specific regulations.
So I can tell you what the rule is. You are required to go out of the rental business for 5 years.
I couldn't get a hold of Centerfit's landlord, so I got on the phone with another landlord, Earl Vaughn. He's the director of a group of landlords called the Apartment Association of Greater Los Angeles.
If an owner finds themselves in a position where they can't make ends meet, they can go out of business.
If it just costs too much to maintain an apartment legally, the Ellis Act allows you, the landlord, to evict your tenants, close up shop, sell the land, repurpose the land. You can do pretty much anything you want except rent those same apartments to new tenants at higher prices. But that way out, It comes at a price.
At the time you invoke the Ellis Act, you must pay relocation fees.
On the books, that's how the Ellis Act is supposed to work. Landlords can't rent those apartments for 5 years. But Walt Centerfit and his neighbors say that's not how it's working on Rodney Drive.
Well, the first tenants moved out in 120 days. The landlord fairly quickly moved somebody else in there, although in our view, he's not permitted to do that.
So Centerfit is fighting back. He's joined forces with his other fellow tenants. They formed the Rodney Drive Tenants Association. They have these big yellow signs that say evicted by Ellis, and they hold protests. Centerfit says he wishes he could retire from work, keep paying $920 a month, and spend all of his time organizing against unfair evictions and the Ellis Act with his neighbors.
But now I won't be able to do that. I'm just going to have to put off my retirement indefinitely, because I will have to be paying more rent in a less desirable place.
That's more rent than he could ever be able to afford on his retirement pension.
The San Bernardino community is still reeling from yesterday's shooting. As Neha Wadaker reports, the Muslim community fears a backlash.
When USC student Mohammed Youssef heard about the shooting, he had one thought.
Oh God, please don't let it be a Muslim. After a lot of events happen in which Muslims are the perpetrators, a lot of the Muslims end up facing backlash because of that. And for instance, I know that there are a lot of women who wear hijab or people who are identifiably Muslim who are afraid of going out and doing common and everyday errands, and just having that looming fear that something might happen to them because of events like this is definitely present within the Muslim community.
Gustavo Ramirez lives in the area and worries that Muhammad's fears may just be right.
The feeling was a complete shock, but in the hours after that and my morning meeting just this morning, there was a lot of hatred and very vocally clear discrimination against Muslims, and so very clear Islamophobia.
The local Islamic community is preparing for the anticipated backlash. Joe Salas is a board member of the Islamic Center of Claremont.
Reacting here at the mosque is we're you know, taking extra security measures because the person happened to be from the Muslim community, and so we're concerned about that. We're organizing with Pomona PD. We have a very good history of working with them. They've always provided extra security for us when we've requested it, and extra patrols in the area, and they're aware of everything that's going on at our center and at our school. And we receive great support from them, the city council, from Claremont PD.
Leaders of other religious organizations are also supporting the Islamic community. Cantor Paul Bush is a member of the Interfaith Coalition.
A few of us just got together and informally discussed what we might do, and it was thought that we could move forward perhaps this morning in just coordinating information about various events that might take place. The hope I have moving forward is that we're going to be able to continue the work that we've done over the years, which is to model how a range of faith communities, a range of ethnic communities, a range of people can get along and learn to go beyond what some might call tolerance into real respect and understanding.
Which is what Gustavo Ramirez hopes as well.
Let this be a wake-up call for the world, starting right here in Pomona and Claremont and San Bernardino, that we have to live differently. And it doesn't start tomorrow. It starts right now at this moment.
The community sees itself at a pivotal moment. It can choose the path of fear and reprisal or work towards a mutual understanding. This is Neha Wadaker with Annenberg Radio News.
If you've been noticing more emojis on your screen, blame it on Apple. When the company updated its software earlier this fall, it came with a hotly anticipated set of nearly 150 new emoji characters. As Laura Grossman reports, emojis are another part of our linguistic evolution.
If you've been long-
longing to text your friend a unicorn, tweet a taco, or email your significant other a gold medal, your wait is finally over. Apple has rolled out an expanded set of emojis for iPhone users. The symbols are once again being highlighted as a popular and useful form of communication in this digital age. Also, they are being touted as a possible indication of a cultural linguistic shift. Language is always evolving. We continually look for better ways to communicate, express, and optimize our thoughts and feelings. Jeremy Burge, the founder of Emojipedia, is immersed in the world of emojis and their impact on the way we express ourselves.
These days, everything we do is text, it's Twitter, it's messages, it's Facebook. So I think it's inevitable that we need more ways to communicate than just plain text.
A decade ago, we might never have imagined that texting could foster deep relationships, but now it has.
We still want to talk to people, we still want to have a joke and have a good time or lend our sympathies, but it's just really difficult to do sometimes in text. Emojis fill that gap. They let us add some mood or emotion to a message without feeling too clinical, perhaps.
We're mostly unaware of it, but we humans mimic each other's expressions and emotions when we're talking in person. We use tools such as intonation, gestures, facial expressions, and body language to convey the message we're trying to send. Scientists refer to this as emotional contagion, and it's a big part of how we show empathy and build relationships with each other. When we look at a smiley face online, the same parts of the brain are activated as when we look at a real human face. They are recognized and processed as nonverbal information, which means we read them as emotional communication, not as words. Jo Meredith is a psychology professor at the University of Salford in the UK. She studies how people use emojis through Facebook.
We don't just use emojis in a frivolous way. We do it to in service of our communication, in service of our interaction.
But this leaves a lot open to interpretation. As an example, here is a very small sampling of how one emoji can be interpreted in vastly different ways. For reference, it's the one that's blue and yellow with a downturned open mouth and raised eyebrows.
You want an emotion, or you want like...
Just like what you think...
First thing that comes out?
Yeah.
Okay. Disbelief.
That one's like so terrified.
Caught off guard.
Worry, concern, some surprise, the mouth is open.
No emoji means just one thing. This elasticity of meaning is a large part of the appeal and perhaps the genius of the emoji. Laura Grossman, Annenberg Radio News.
If you've ever wondered about the origins of curious words and phrases, here's Holly Thomas with today's Root Source.
Nothing says, baby, it's cold outside, like a delicious glass of eggnog. Eggnog is a chilled, spiced milk drink combined with beaten egg yolks and bourbon rum or whiskey that is typically served around Christmas time. Drinking a raw egg yolk mixture may be strange enough, but the history of eggnog is arguably even more curious. The earliest form of eggnog is posset, a 13th century British milky ale drink, and it was only when America was colonized in the 16th century that eggnog became associated with the holidays. But what is eggnog? Egg is an Old Norse word and refers to its main ingredient. Nog, however, is a little more complex. One theory is it comes from the Old English word noggin, was a small wooden cup or a small drink of spirits.
Give me some fin. Noggin.
Another theory is that it refers to a Scottish nugged ale, which was ale heated with a hot poker. Either way, fans agree, all you need to spice up your holidays is a little eggnog. Even George Washington wrote his own recipe.
American composer Miguel de Aguilar was born in Uruguay, and the music of his birthplace is infused in his music. In this sound portrait, he shares the inspiration behind his most recent Grammy-nominated work, Concerto de Tango.
My name is Miguel del Águila. I'm a musician, I'm a composer. I was recently nominated for the third time for a Grammy, and that was for the Best Classical Contemporary Composition 2015 for the Latin Grammy. The piece that was nominated, it's Concierto en Tango. It was actually the cellist Roman Mekhinilov, who wanted to have this piece. He's the first cellist of the Buffalo Philharmonic. He wanted to have a concerto that was written in tango form. He wanted something different, so he asked the conductor, Joan Falera, and Joan sent me an email.
When I began to think seriously about commissioning the Tango Concerto for Roman, I thought of Miguel del Aguilar right away. I knew his music, I performed other works of his, and I consider him one of the greatest composers.
Cello concertos in the classical repertoire, they are very 19th century, very romantic. And she said, Roman wants a cello concerto, but he doesn't want it to sound very classical. He wanted to be more of a tango form, more your type of music. The cello is, it's very compatible with tango because it has that very intense expression, almost melodramatic, and that tango is melodramatic.
My name is Roman Mikhailov. I'm a principal cellist of the Buffalo Philharmonic Orchestra.
Roman is originally from Russia, but he spent quite a bit of time playing as solo cellist in Sao Paulo. And while living in Sao Paulo, he became fascinated by South American music and fell in love with it.
A lot of people born with it, especially in Latin America, you know. And if you're a composer, you're bound to have some tango experiences and in general. But Miguel definitely was born with it. There's a certain timing about tangos that only people who really understand it know. And Miguel does.
Once somebody puts in my mind the idea of this piece that's coming, I really, you can't stop it. The sound of the cello, it colors everything you write. Then the performer, if you know the performer well, they are part of the personality of this piece. And then, you know, your music. What you want to say, what the memories that type of music brings you, it all kind of cooks together in that soup that will be the next piece. You know, the music of your childhood, the music of the times when you grow up, so embedded in your mind, your memories, that that has been the constant in my music wherever I went. The music that I carry inside is like you're traveling and that's your luggage, right? Musically. So in the times when I was growing up, it was a very Uruguay, Montevideo, Buenos Aires, that's where my childhood was spent. It was a very different place than what it's now. And tango was still very much alive. This piece, it also included a lot of nostalgia, a lot of looking back and remembering those times.
That sound portrait was produced by Donna Granada. That's it for From Where We Are, and that's it for the semester. Thanks to our Thursday crews, Mira Jordan, Nurhan Mamoun, Hannah Vicente, Marina Pena, and Kate Dowd. We also had help from Thibaut Claris-Gauthier, Tufan Najafi, Caitlin Plummer, and Brianna Feldot. Thanks a million to our newscast host, Sebastian Vega. Our board operator is Lexi McAvinci, and our tech guru is Sebastian Gruba. Victor Figueroa is our editing whiz, and Martha Daniel is our producer. And for all of us here at the Annenberg Media Center, I'm Carla Javier.